back in February of this year, we invited you, our wonderful, enthusiastic community, to be part of the Plan Strong Test Kitchen and provide us with feedback around our all-new burger mixes. And I got to tell you, the feedback and support that you guys showed us blew us away, and we have been hard at work in the kitchen, and we now have our first program graduates, three delicious skillet burger mixes. We're going to be launching them into the universe so you can stock up ahead of Memorial Day weekend. You can check them out at planstrong.com. The three flavors are black bean, portobello mushroom, and our all-new sweet curry. Once mixed with 6 to 7 ounces of water or broth, the dough may be pan-fried, air-fried, or baked to a crispy, aromatic, rich golden brown. These mixes, they take the hard work out of making healthy burgers at home and yield quality results. They're whole grain, oil-free, a great source of protein and fiber, and they're made from a combination of ground oats, beans, seeds, and spices without any of the added sugar or excessive salt. I want to thank all of you for being such an important part of the Plant Strong Test Kitchen, and I know that you're going to love these as much as I do. Thanks so much.
But we were seeing people have their blood pressures come down very quickly. They would have a more typical omnivorous diet, and they would switch to almost exclusively or exclusively plant-based, and their high blood pressure would come down. And in fact, oftentimes 2 weeks after they would start eating this way, I would get a phone call, a message that's, you know, patient so-and-so is lightheaded now. And what that was that they were healing themselves so much, they didn't need as many blood pressure lowering pills. So we started peeling off blood pressure lowering pills.
Season 3 of the Plant Strong podcast explores those Galileo moments where you seek to understand the real truth around your health and dare to see the world through a different lens. This season, we honor those courageous seekers who are paving the way for you and me. So grab your telescope, point it towards your future, and let's get Plant Strong together. Our 10th anniversary Plant Stock celebration is online and on sale. Grab a friend and join us virtually from September 8th to the 12th as we honor all the progress that's been made over the last decade with the science, with the food, and with the movement as a whole. It is nothing short of phenomenal what has happened. This will be the perfect way to invite that family member who desperately needs a green leafy intervention to come take a drink from the fire hose and learn everything they can about the why and the how of Plant Strong Living. And in honor of our 10th anniversary, and as part of my mission to reach as many people as possible with the good news about plants, group tickets are just $10 a piece when you buy five. $10 gets you access to life-changing information to help start or strengthen your Plant Strong journey. Our lineup this year includes the ultimate rock stars. Can you say T. Colin Campbell, Caldwell Esselstyn, Dr. Michael Greger, Dr. Michael Clapper, Christy Funk, Will Bolshewitz, the Scherzeis, the list goes on and on and on. Don't miss out. Visit plantstrong.com/plantstock to sign up today. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Plant Strong podcast. I'm your host, Rip Esselstyn. And I'm going to call this episode with Dr. Robert Osfeld, who's a cardiologist at Montefiore Hospital in the Bronx. I'm going to call this the Miracle at Montefiore, because what he has done at Montefiore and the example that he is setting there is truly, it is miraculous. He is the director and the founder of the Preventive Medicine Cardiac Wellness Program at Montefiore. He went into medicine because he didn't want to make little changes in people's health. He wanted to make radical transformative changes in people's health. And he realized that the approach and the paradigm that he had learned was doing just that. It was making little gains. And when he stumbled on plant-based nutrition, tried it out for himself, he realized that this was the answer that he was looking for with his patients as well. And the results speak for themselves. He was also able to get the hospital to serve plant-based food for people recovering from a heart procedure, which is absolutely phenomenal. This is a man who is the real deal through and through. He has got his MD from Yale University, Master's of Science in Epidemiology at Harvard, and then went on to get his degree in his specialty of cardiology. But this man is fascinating. What he's doing is spectacular. And I can't wait for you to hear all the great things that Dr. Robert Ostfeld is doing at Montefiore. Let's take it away. So, Dr. Robert Ostfeld, it is so fantastic to have you on the Plant Strong podcast. I can't believe that it's taken 3 years to get you on, but here we are. Are you in New York right now?
I am in New York City. It's great. And it is such an incredible honor to be here with you and your audience. I love the work that you're doing, your family's doing. It's just an incredible inspiration. It's terrific to be here.
Yeah, well, thank you, Robert. So I want to talk to you about the miracle that you have worked at Montefiore. Am I pronouncing that right? Is it Montefiore?
Yeah, that's great. Montefiore. Perfect. Okay.
All right. At Montefiore. Because to me, you have worked miracles. Before we talk about the miracles that you've worked there, I want to backtrack for a sec. And I think it's important. And, you know, you've been a speaker at our Plant Stock event in the past. And to me, you have a really compelling and riveting kind of journey that kind of launched you into medicine. And I'd love if you could share with our audience what inspired the, first of all, the journey into medicine, and then secondarily, and I want to pepper you with some questions, but
sure.
Then why your interest in plant-based?
Got it.
Yeah.
Well, so thank you. And the reason that I got interested in medicine is because when I was a young kid, I had two brothers who died from an incurable disease. And so ever since I was a young kid, I'd been interested in medicine and health. And that is what led me to become a physician. From the time I even, I think, was in high school, I was pretty much on that path.
Do you know what were the incurable diseases that your brothers got? Is it something that's well known or very rare?
It's pretty well known. It's called Tay-Sachs, and it is not uncommon in French Canadian populations and in Ashkenazi Jewish populations. And I'm an Ashkenazi Jew. And so there, to my knowledge, remains no cure for it, but you know, there's all kinds of research going on in the area. And so there's growing hope. And basically, you're missing an enzyme. And my understanding of it is probably too simplistic, but you have an enzyme that controls kind of fatty tissue, the amount of it in your brain, and we all need a certain amount, but you're missing an enzyme in Tay-Sachs, and that tissue, fatty tissue just grows and grows and slowly takes over the brain. There's no cure for it. You slip into a coma and you die. Mm-hmm. My brother, Daniel, died when I was 7. He was about a little under four. Some of the memories I have, I don't remember if they're stories that I heard or pictures. And some of them are definitely my own personal memories. And my brother Michael lived a much shorter period of time. I don't have memories of him, but I have memories of my brother Daniel. And, you know, it was, I look at their part of what I get to do with preventive cardiology and plant-based nutrition as part of their legacy, and our program as part of their legacy to try to help people be healthier. And their lives are an inspiration to me. And we used to have a conference, which we had for about 3 years, on preventive cardiology, plant-based nutrition based at Montefiore, that your father spoke at, and we were honored to host him. And, you know, it's been on hold now because of COVID, but we had a Daniel Michael Osfeld Memorial Lecture as part mm-hmm. of that conference. So I look at our work, which is very much inspired by your family, your father, you, as part of the legacy of my brothers.
Do you have any other siblings?
I do. I have a younger brother, Scott, who is doing really well, has three kids, and he's plant-based. And I remember many, many years ago, I brought over like almond milk or something to his home, and he kind of gave me a look and laughed a little bit. And now he is plant-based. So right. It was a cool evolution.
Good. Okay. So, all right. So your brothers really inspired you to go into medicine. And it's amazing the legacy that you're doing for them. So let's talk for a second about your interest in plant-based. But before we do, I really want to share with people your education, because I think that that's really important. So your undergraduate work was at University of Pennsylvania, right? Then you went to Yale for your degree in medicine. And then you went to Harvard, if I'm not mistaken, to get your Master of Science in Epidemiology. Is that correct?
Yes.
Right. And then at some point you decided you're going to go into cardiology. Why cardiology?
Well, I'd always been interested in the physical exam and the heart. I kind of like in anatomy class and in medical school, I just seemed to like the heart kind of interest me the most of the different body parts. But, and so I'd always had that in the back of my mind. And then when I went up to Boston to do my, you know, residency in general internal medicine, like during that time, it's like a 3-year period of time, you kind of decide if you want to do a subspecialty, like an internist is sort of like a general pediatrician for adults. And sometimes an internist will then specialize in the kidney or in an organ system, the kidney, the lung, the heart. So the heart's doctors are cardiologists. So during the residency is when you kind of like have to apply for fellowship and kind of formalize it. And so I'd always had an interest in the area. And I remember I was doing this elective because I was ultimately deciding between endocrinology, being like a hormone doctor, like thyroid and testosterone, things like that, and cardiology, because both of them really intrigued me. And so I'm doing the endocrinology elective, and I walk into a patient's room, and suddenly the patient flips into an abnormal heart rhythm. You know, and I'm the only one there, so of course I'm dealing with it. And I realized that I enjoyed taking care of the abnormal heart rhythm more than I enjoyed taking care of the hormone issue.
Right.
So I'm like, well, that's a sign. That means something. So one thing led to another, and I became a cardiologist.
Yes, you did. And did you immediately come out as a cardiologist at Montefiore?
So I did all my training up in Boston. And then when I finished all of that, my family is in the greater New York area, and I always knew that I wanted to come back closer to home. So I luckily found a position at Montefiore, which is in the Bronx. And one of the things about Montefiore that was really appealing to me is that there's a lot of medical need in the area. There, like, I think New York State has something like 50 counties, and Bronx, in terms of health, is last 50th, and it's not even close to like 49.
Wow.
It might be the least healthful inner city in the whole US. It's a title no one wants. I guess it depends on how you define things, but there's a lot of medical need there. And there's a very large indigent patient population. And I wanted to use, my training, the legacy of my brothers to, help people in need. And so I wound up at Montefiore to work as a cardiologist. So in 2003, finished up fellowship, moved down to New York City and started working.
And you're a cardiologist there. And what kind of cardiologist are you there? Are you, because there's a lot of different cardiologists, correct?
Or you're absolutely right. There's all kinds of ways to slice and dice it and make it extra complicated sounding.
Yeah.
So you could be a non-invasive cardiologist, which is what I am. And that generally means you see patients in clinic, you see patients in the hospital, you read ultrasound pictures of the heart, maybe stress tests. There are electrophysiologists, another kind of cardiologists that do heart rhythm disorders, pacemakers, defibrillators. There are invasive cardiologists that put in stents and other things. Now there's a whole other area in cardiology now, like structural cardiologists that do fancy valve procedures where they go in through an artery and replace valves without open heart surgery. It's really unbelievable the advances that are happening. It's incredible. So I personally am a non-invasive cardiologist, and about 80% of my time is seeing patients, and about 20% of my time is various academic pursuits, whether it's teaching, doing research, starting initiatives, programs. So that's my role at Montefiore.
Your role at Montefiore is you're the founder and director of the preventive medicine, right? Or cardiology, which, I mean, when did you, let's backtrack for a sec. So you're a non-invasive cardiologist at Montefiore, but I'm assuming when you started in 2003, that you didn't know anything about a plant-based diet. Is that right?
You're 100% correct. I was always really interested in prevention, and I did a year of preventive research during my fellowship, and I got to work with great people, but I really learned almost nothing about diet, almost nothing about nutrition. Like when I was done, I kind of knew that a Mediterranean style diet was pretty good, but I couldn't really define it. And that was really it when it came to diet. And so when I came down to Montefiore, that's what I kind of knew. And then I would encourage patients to eat more of a Mediterranean style diet and do procedures and medications and things as necessary. And then people got a little bit better, but there wasn't transformational change. And so I was a little bummed about that. I'm like, I didn't go into medicine just to move the needle a teeny bit.
Right.
So that was a real bummer for me. And I remember one weekend early on, I'm on call and I'm sitting in the hospital, it was like a Sunday or something. And I'm like, it just seems like the only people in our division who are really saving people are the invasive cardiologists who put in stents at 3 a.m. for a giant heart attack.
Yeah.
It's wonderful that they can do that. But I'm like, there's gotta be more. There has to be other ways to prevent this stuff. And certainly the medications and the minimal degree of lifestyle change that I was espousing then is helpful, but the progression to additional disease, another stent, heart failure, another admission to the hospital for heart disease just kept on going.
Yeah.
So I was getting disillusioned.
Who introduced you to plant-based?
Yeah. So a friend of mine, she handed me Colin Campbell's book, The China Study. And so at the same time, I was also running cardiology grand rounds at Montefiore. And that's kind of a big weekly academic talk that the whole division goes to. It's kind of an important lecture, and you invite all kinds of leading academicians. So she hands me this book, The China Study. And she's like, you're going to like this. I'm like, okay. So, I'm a myopic cardiologist, and there's a small section in the middle that's about cardiology. So, of course, I just go there first. And I started reading about, the plant-based diet and the work of your dad. And I'm like, wow, this is really amazing.
So, you didn't, so, So you didn't immediately poo-poo it. You were like, there might be something to this.
Yeah. I definitely did not immediately poo-poo it at all. I'm like, wow, this is super impressive. And I mean, I had to learn more about it, obviously, but I just hadn't, those kinds of patient turnarounds, I had not seen. And that very much aligned with my proclivity toward prevention.
Yeah.
So I'm like, wow, this seems great. And I was fortunate at the time to be running the cardiology grand rounds. So I had the opportunity to invite all kinds of speakers in this space in. So, you know, we were honored to host your dad and Dr. Campbell and other people in this space as well. I think we had Dr. Willett. Another motivation was to sort of like hammer it into the cardiology faculty as well. So I got to learn more, and then I got to expose all of our faculty, our fellows and the various other trainees coming through cardiology to this information.
Which is brilliant on your part, because otherwise they're hearing it just from you. And, you know, I would imagine that an invasive cardiologist is not going to be too receptive to this information.
Yeah, it remains an uphill climb in some portions of medicine. But, you know, like, I'm sure you see it for yourself, but as it's become an easier and easier sell, you know, certainly as society has changed, you know, that helps move the needle. You know, the American College of Cardiology guidelines, which we can get into a little more, have definitely moved the needle way more toward plant-based nutrition. So it's an easier sell now. But back then, we're talking like 2006, 2007, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
It was harder. And like, I mean, I remember, so I guess I'm fast forwarding, we'll back up a second. Like, so I become plant-based cardiologist around then, and we could talk about that a little bit, but I'm looking around New York City, right? 9 million people. And I don't know everybody, but I didn't know a single other plant-based physician in all of New York City. It's like 9 million people. The closest one was your dad. I mean, the closest physician doing it was your dad in Cleveland. I'm like, this can't possibly be. And of course, very soon after that, I got to know Dr. Michelle McMackin.
Yeah.
And now there's a whole plant posse. All kinds of plant-based people.
No plant. there is. Well, you got in during basically, you know, the medieval times for the most part.
Yeah.
when it really wasn't a thing. It's nutty now. I mean, you know, we all know of Dr. Kim Williams at Rush and what he's done there as the president of the American College of Cardiologists, and what I think that I've read that on his staff of cardiologists, there 23 or 24 are now plant-based.
Yeah, something amazing. He's done great work. His words are more influential than mine. I don't have 95% plant-based faculty.
Right, but and then you know, I love his quote, which is something like, you know, there's two types of cardiologists, right? Those who are vegan and those who have yet to read the data.
Yeah, it's a great quote.
So, I mean, I'd love for you to share with our audience, you've said that this is probably the most powerful form of medicine that you know of outside of, you know, some sort of an acute injury that, you know, needs to be healed, like a gunshot wound or something like that. Can you speak to that? Like you eat this way to heal your heart and what happens as what are some of the bonuses that happen when you start eating this way?
Sure. So, I mean, yeah, the kinds of benefits that we see are tremendous. And so, you know, I became plant-based and I started to eat this way myself as well, because I'm like, well, if it's going to be good for patients, you know, presumably it'll be good for me also. So I'm like, why not do that? But for our patients, first, it was, you know, kind of anecdotal because we were just starting out and getting our feet wet, but we were seeing patients who, now, mind you, these, you know, we're also using medications and procedures when necessary. I mean, those things are also important. It's really all of the above to protect people. But we were seeing people have their blood pressures come down very quickly. They would have a more typical omnivorous diet, and they would switch to almost exclusively or exclusively plant-based, and their blood pressures, their high blood pressure would come down. And in fact, oftentimes 2 weeks after they would start eating this way, I would get a phone call, a message that's, you know, patient so-and-so is lightheaded now.
Ah.
And what that was that they were healing themselves so much, they didn't need as many blood pressure lowering pills. So we started peeling off blood pressure lowering pills. And actually, like, sometimes if they call the primary care doctor who may not know as much at the time about plant-based nutrition, they would tell the patient to go back to eating how they were before, to have more salt. I mean, it was like 180. Like, oh my God. Anyway, so we would see that. We would see cholesterol fall a lot. And I usually wouldn't recheck it for like 3 months because like I wouldn't, you know, see them or wouldn't check it like a week later. But after like 3 months, we would see LDL, bad cholesterol, not uncommonly come down 20, 30% in people, which is great. And that's kind of like the same level that you would see with a low-dose statin. And, you know, there's randomized controlled data to support that. Dr. Jenkins' portfolio diet study, where he took people and had them on a high-fiber plant-based diet and also on a low dose of a statin, and the LDL cholesterol fell to a similar degree. And also, I should say, in terms of high blood pressure, there's randomized controlled data, the DASH, the Dietary Approach to Stop Hypertension data, which is basically a typical Western diet versus almost a fully plant-based diet, not completely, but way, way more plant-based. And there were significant drops in blood pressure there. So the kind of the anecdotes that I was seeing are backed up by, you know, much more robust kind of information. We would see patients who had angina or chest pain or chest pressure, for example, because of cholesterol blockages in the blood vessels that feed their heart with blood. As a cardiologist, unfortunately, we see a lot of that. But over a couple of weeks, their symptoms would start to improve. And, you know, sometimes it could take months before it might fully resolve. And sometimes patients didn't require procedures. But, you know, we would begin to see turnarounds very quickly in that kind of symptom. Certainly there is data to support that. Some of Dr. Ornish's work, where he would, in randomized control studies, would have patients have over time less angina, improvements in stress test findings as well, which supported our anecdotal findings. People would tell me that their erectile function would improve. And, I had one patient who said that now he is a rock star in the bedroom. I don't know what his wife thinks, but that's what he thinks. There's randomized controlled data to support that too, with a Mediterranean style diet, not fully plant-based, but more plant-based.
Well, you've actually, I think it's you that has this quote, and that is, the way to a man's heart is through his penis.
And I don't know. I wish I could take credit for that quote. It's a good quote. But
I think that you, and if I'm not mistaken, haven't you started a research study?
Yeah. So thank you for asking. It hasn't started right now. We're targeting December. We hit a lot of hiccups and hurdles because of COVID. So we were geared up to go, and then, COVID hit and everything. We are going to look at the impact of dietary pattern on erectile function in young, healthy men. So we're going to randomize young, healthy men between like 18 and 30 years of age to either a couple days of plant-based diet or a couple days of animal-based diet, and then cross them over to the other arm and measure their erectile function with the Rigiscan device.
Right.
In a rigorous way. We'll see what happens. We hypothesize that it will improve with a plant-based diet, but we don't know until we do it.
So how much of this research study was inspired by the game changers and what Dr. Aaron Spitz did with those collegiate athletes with the Rigiscan?
Oh, it's definitely a part of it for sure. And it was sort of like a whole bunch of moving parts came together at the same time. We were separately having conversations before I even knew about that scene. And I was having conversations with other people. So all kinds of planets, like a line, like Halley's Comet came around or something.
Yeah.
And boom, it all just came together. And we're very fortunate that Dr. Spitz is going to be one of the co-authors on our study. You know, I work with him and we text about it regularly. He's been an incredible source of help and information.
Yeah, no, he is a rock star in that department. No doubt about it. Truly. All right, gang. Want to share an Instagram message that I just got. This is from a gentleman. His name is George Vlagos. And before I do, I want to just share a little side note here. He just happened to be the first customer to spot our new Plant Strong broths, chilies, and stews inside his local Whole Food Market store that's in Wheaton, Illinois. And he did it. He found it after visiting both downtown Chicago stores to try and find the new products. So he was persevering. He was on the hunt for the new Plant Strong products, and really appreciate that, George. He went on to share that he's been Plant Strong since 2019 when he saw my book, my first book, The Engine 2 Diet, that was being sold at his local Whole Foods store. And at the time, he was in fantastic shape. He was working out 6 days a week. He weighed a trim, lean, and mean 165 pounds. But guess what? His cholesterol was a staggering 330. And one of the things that I tell people is it doesn't matter how hot your engine burns, you don't burn away cholesterol. It doesn't work that way, right? If you want to bring down the cholesterol, you got to bring down the saturated fat, the dietary cholesterol, the animal protein, and you want to be like hammering it with all the fantastic substances, the phytonutrients, the antioxidants that you get in whole plant-based foods. Now, since reading The Engine 2 Diet, he's gone all in, and he said that he's not had a drop of oil since he started, and his cholesterol is now right as rain, and he's never felt better. And that, to me, is not surprising. And I want to appreciate and thank George for sharing his story, and huge congrats on his success. Now, everybody that's listening, I want you to hear this. This is a participatory lifestyle. This is a participatory sport, meaning anyone that's out there listening, you can achieve these results not by listening to podcasts and not by reading books, although it's helpful, but by engaging with the lifestyle. I mean, you literally have to stick a fork in it and dig in. We want you up to your knees, waist, chest in this lifestyle, and I promise you, you won't regret it. So, kale yeah to George, and keep it plant strong. Thanks. And just so people understand, as a cardiologist, and again, I don't know if this is your quote, but it's kind of like the canary in the coal mine, right, is ED. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. So we look at erectile dysfunction as the canary in the coal mine for heart disease. Now, the way people get an erection is, you know, there's a psychological or neurological or physical stimulation, and then, you know, people can get an erection. And what happens is there's blood flow to the penis, and the artery to the penis where the blood flows in is pretty small. And so by the time there's a blockage in that artery that may limit blood flow into the penis and cause some erectile dysfunction, there are many reasons to have erectile dysfunction. That's one of them, but that's the most common one. By the time there's a blockage there, it is extremely likely that you have a blockage in the blood vessels in the heart that just has not clinically manifest yet because those arteries are a little bit bigger. And typically, erectile dysfunction presents around 3 to 5 years before overt cardiovascular disease. So it really is a canary in the coal mine and a great opportunity for us to intervene with risk factors and lifestyle changes.
That's fascinating. I never heard that before, that it usually precedes the heart disease by 3 to 5 years, which in some ways actually, to me, now that I'm hearing this for the first time, makes sense, because, you know, those coronary arteries are about, you know, 5 times bigger than the artery to the penis. So
yeah, that's exactly right. We wrote a review article in the American Journal of Medicine, and Dr. Spitz is one of the co-authors on it, all about lifestyle and erectile function. We get into, you know, why it happens and the impact of various lifestyle changes on erectile function.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have you and Aaron back after you guys have done this study. How long will it take to do the study?
It probably up to 2 years. It could be one year. We're going to look at the data after we have 38 people enrolled.
Yeah.
And we bake that into the statistics. So if we see a significant difference, then we can stop. And that might take us a year or so. But if we don't see a significant difference, then we'll extend it up to about 72 people. And so I don't know. We'll see how well we do with recruitment and enrollment and stuff.
That's fascinating right there. Can't wait to see the results of that. Let me ask you this. What are some of the youngest patients that you see coming into Montefiore that actually have like confirmed heart disease? Do you see anybody like as a teenager with that?
So as an adult cardiologist, I typically don't really get exposed to people until around the years 18 to 21.
Yep.
There's like kind of a vague line. When does childhood start and adulthood begin? But, we certainly see diabetes and high cholesterol, even in teenagers or younger, with obesity now. I mean, that is not uncommon at all.
Yeah.
Which is terrible, because, you know, we can look at a number of these disease processes as like area under the curve. Like, how long are you exposed to diabetes? How long are you exposed to high cholesterol? How long are you exposed to high blood pressure? And these things add up over time. It's like a disaster. And so you have problems way earlier in life. And so like the youngest person that I've seen with like a heart attack that hadn't been, you know, sometimes people will use drugs or other substances that can trigger these things. But the youngest person that I've seen with a garden variety heart attack without a genetic predisposition, without any illicit use, in their very early 20s.
Is that a male or female?
It was a male.
Yeah.
But typically, you know, our typical patients are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, but they have been, you know, the seeds for the problem have been growing for a long time. You know, maybe they've been, obese for a while, and their blood pressure has been too high for a while, and their cholesterol has been too high for a while, maybe not the most ideal lifestyle. And it's, you know, this is definitely not patient blaming at all. Like, society is not built to make the healthy choice, the easy choice. And certainly there are genetic contributions and social determinants of health and all a very complicated milieu. But the seeds of the problem, as you know, start very, very early.
So in doing my research for this, I saw you mentioned in one of your interviews in Johannesburg, South Africa, over a 10-year period, just to kind of where they, eat predominantly plant-based, to see what kind of heart disease do they have there. In this one hospital, going back 10 years, roughly 40,000 visits a year, or 40,000 patients, so a total of 400,000. And I want you to say it. How many people of those 400,000 over 10 years had heart disease, you know, written down?
Yeah. So the best, it's good memory. Like, I had forgotten about the study by Dr. Burkett. And this was about 40,000 patients a year. It was a more indigenous population, not a westernized population of people. And they were having, they're physically active, plant-based diet. And I think there may have been 30.
30. No, that's the number. It was 30. 30 out of 400,000.
Yeah, exactly. Over 10 years.
Yeah.
And you could go to, you know, the Cleveland Clinic right now where your dad is, you can go to Montefiore right now where I am, and there are more than 30 heart patients on the floor this very second.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, and then it's so interesting. There is this wonderful study of the Simonet people that was published in Lancet in 2017. And they're an indigenous population out of Bolivia. And they eat mostly a plant-based diet. I think 72% of their calories is carbs, 14% animal protein, 14% fat. They're very physically active, and they have the lowest rates of heart disease ever recorded in the medical literature.
How low? Like, how can you get lower than that?
well, that's true. But I guess what I should say, because they had CAT scans, so it was like very rigorously assessed, as opposed to like maybe somebody miswrote it in a chart. So more rigorously assessed with CAT scans, and their vascular age is felt to be about 20, 25 years younger than a typical Westerner. So their diet is largely plant-based. I mean, it's obviously a complicated milieu. They're not exposed to pollution. They're living much more of an indigenous lifestyle, but it just highlights how powerfully lifestyle can impact cardiovascular disease.
Well, and for you, as somebody that is trained and has a degree in epidemiology, I mean, this is just, you must go, I mean, come on, what more do we need? Right? This is so powerful.
Exactly. It's disappointing and invigorating at the same time, because you see all the potential opportunity and then you see all the headwinds. There's all kinds of data that even if people make modest changes, you know, have a few more servings of fruits and vegetables, eat a little less junk food, a little fewer animal products, that they see all kinds of benefits. So, you know, on an epidemiologic level, we don't have to have perfection be the enemy of good.
Right.
And if you look, there's all these dietary studies where if they look at the way people eat and they say, okay, we're going to define a perfect diet. It's not perfect. It's like a handful of fruits and vegetables a day, low salt, you know, low sugar, some whole grains, and some of these studies will say a little bit of fish. And if you have the perfect diet, you know, they'll have five levels. And if you're in the highest quintile, that's considered more ideal. And in one of the studies, 0.7% of the U.S. achieved the ideal diet as defined by that. And like 58% was in the lowest category defined by that. We are not even within 100 miles of eating reasonably optimally in the U.S. There's a really cool study out of Framingham, the Framingham Heart Study, which got cholesterol and risk factors on the map. And they looked at, you know, ultra-processed food, junk food, like, you know, sugar cereals, chips, stuff like that. And shocker, the more you ate, the worse you did. But the thing to me that was super interesting about this study is the average person, there were 3,000 people in this, the average person had 7.5 servings a day of ultra processed foods. I mean, it's like, what do you have time to eat? How can you eat anything else? You know, it's like, we're so far away from ideal so there are some serious headwinds. Now, when you see it in the hospital, people, you know, I talked to some of the cardiology fellows and I'm like, hey, when's the last time you saw someone just with lifestyle change, their angina improved, lose 25 pounds, their cholesterol falls, their diabetes goes away? And they're like, never.
Yeah.
We don't see it. But we see it regularly, of course, with a plant-based diet.
So let's talk about the food for a sec. So when I say, or somebody asked you, so Dr. Osfeld, what does a whole food plant-based diet mean? Give me your just kind of Reader's Digest version of what that means.
To me, it's a minimally processed or smartly processed plant-based diet. And so, you know, sugar cookies can be plant-based, can be vegan, but they're not healthy. No one thinks that they're healthy. So to me, a smartly or minimally processed plant-based diet is tons of green leafy vegetables, fruits, other vegetables, herbs and spices, beans, lentils, chickpeas, peas, tofu, baked potatoes. For many patients, avocado and raw nuts. and getting rid of the ultra processed foods and, you know, getting rid of the animal based foods, particularly processed meat and red meat in particular.
Yeah.
And, you know, if someone is going to go down that path, we, you know, we certainly want them to supplement vitamin B12. And I'll also often ask patients to supplement omega-3 as mm-hmm. well, not necessarily for heart health, but for brain health, because although you might be able to get ALA, alpha-linolenic acid, from hemp seeds, chia seeds, ground flaxseed meal, not everybody converts that all that well into other omega-3s. So I will often belt and suspender that with an omega-3 supplement. So to me, it's a minimally or smartly processed plant-based diet, you know, brown rice and beans, big salad, lots of wonderful options, literally anything that's in your cookbook.
Yeah. Got it. To me, one of the miracles that you have pulled off at Montefiore is, and I, you correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think you were the first to make this happen, is you now offer your cardiac patients a whole food plant-based meal option as they're recovering. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was a really interesting adventure. I don't know for sure if we were the first. We were definitely the first, or at least I think we were the first, to have forks over knives playing for free for patients on one of the inpatient channels. I mean, you could watch something else, but we also have it on the inpatient TVs, and it has Spanish subtitles, which is very important for our patient population. And it plays just on continuous loop, which is great. So kind of the story with that is, you know, we already had our outpatient program where you see patients in clinic going strong. We would help them become more plant-based. We had the Saturday morning sessions modeled after your father's sessions, where patients would come with a friend or significant other, and we take a deep dive into how and why plant-based nutrition. I worked with the nutritionist Lauren Graff and RD Lauren Graff on that a lot. And we wouldn't charge patients for it. We would fund it all through donations. There's a very large indigent patient population where I am. And so we wanted to democratize this information. So our outpatient program was going strong, but I would also round in the hospital, you know, for patients who were admitted after a heart attack or for whatever reason they're in the hospital. And I would mention plant-based nutrition. And, you know, I'd go rah-rah plants. And then I'd leave the room, and 10 minutes later, dinner served, and, you know, it's chicken or something. Yeah. I'm like, it's totally undercut and it's not working. So we worked with food services, and really was a wonderful collaborative effort with nutrition and food services and multiple chefs throughout our system to make, you know, ethnically relevant meals. And we built a plant-based menu.
Wow.
You know, it's not five-star Michelin, but it is, you know, decent.
And how long did it take from, like, when you hatched that idea to where you're actually serving it to the patients? Is that a 2-year journey?
Yeah, 18 to 24 months. Yeah. I mean, that sentence took a long time to materialize.
Yeah.
And I remember we would sit down, you know, and like, okay, we'd love to have, maybe let's have some hummus and this or that. And then they'd be like, okay, that's beyond our ability. It's too costly. So we'd have to, you know, revamp it. And so a lot of trial and error, and then getting it into the medical record system and all this stuff. But finally it worked, and it's been there for a long time now, many years. And we have a electronic medical record, and you can just go in and click and boom, you can order cardiac plant-based diet. Which is great. And it doesn't always, but it's supposed to come with a handout. And you can also watch Forks Over Knives on TV. So now I can walk into a patient's room, go rah-rah plants. We order the meals.
Yeah.
You get the handout, hopefully, and you can put on Forks Over Knives. So now I have my plant-based posse with me.
So are you able to keep track of the data? So, like, just for example, let's say over the month of June, you had 100 cardiac patients. How many of those 100 are picking the plant-based option?
Well, so I don't have that data. I would love to. So, but the good news is that we are at Montefiore, the physicians or the physician assistants order the meals. And it's not like a patient gets a menu. It's just how it works in our system. So they order the meals. And I keep on pushing to have it be used more and more throughout the system. Right now, the plant-based meals, I think, are offered in 3 of our hospitals. With, you know, that's got to be like 1,200, 1,500 beds.
Wow.
And, you know, not everybody's getting it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like herding cats. People come, people go. And we're actually, I've been pushing for this for a while. It hasn't happened yet, but I want to make it the default meal on one of our cardiology floors and have it grow and grow. And the person who runs clinical cardiology is definitely aligned with that. So I'm very hopeful that it will happen. But it's been a great adventure. It's a wonderful resource for us. And it's led to all other kinds of initiatives. Like, for example, I make our cardiology fellows have there's a little question in their note, their consult note template.
Yeah.
If they ever see a consult in the hospital, they have to ask, does the patient consume at least 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day? And the answer is yes, no, deferred. Like if you're intubated and can't speak, you know, it's deferred, obviously.
Yeah.
And we put that right over the assessment and plan. So for people who read medical notes, they'll know that that's good real estate. So you'll see it. So the point of that is to drill it home. It's a simple intervention, to drill it home to the fellows that it's important, to drill it home to anyone who reads the cardiology consult note that cardiology thinks it's important, and to drill it home to the patient, you know, that their physician thinks it's important. And hopefully as the years go by and people graduate and they go to different places, it spreads throughout the, you know, medical system slowly. And it's totally non-controversial. Like the American Heart Association, World Health Organization, they recommend 4 to 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day.
Yeah.
Not controversial.
So do you know, following your lead, is this happening all over New York, for example?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is not our doing, but through PCRM, and we certainly were cheering them on in other groups. You know, Eric Adams, the incredible Brooklyn Borough president, will be the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York City. There, I believe in New York State, yes, it's mandated in New York State that the hospitals at least offer a plant-based meal. That doesn't, for inpatients. And it doesn't mean they have to, the patient has to get it, but they at least have to be able to offer it.
Wow.
And PCRM was involved with that, and they did something similar in California. So the needle is shifting. And of course, Eric Adams has been very involved with the city hospital system with Dr. McMackin doing wonderful things at Bellevue. And if he is to become mayor, presumably it'll get a lot more attention, a lot more funding and resources.
Can you imagine? Yeah, we had Eric on the podcast 2 seasons ago. And I just, you know, he has a saying that I love. And he says, how goes Brooklyn goes New York goes the USA goes the world. And, you know, with the help of Eric, I think we'll be able to really, really move that needle.
Yeah.
It'll be really cool. That to me, it is so miraculous, so Herculean that you were able to make that happen. And I think it must be a testament to, you know, not only your fortitude, but also, you know, the passion and the results that you're getting there. So kudos to you on being such a trailblazer like that.
Well, thank you. It's very generous of you to say. It was really a labor of love, you know, wrapped in a pit bull.
I love that.
But yeah, so well, thank you. And we were super psyched about our conference and stuff, and
yeah,
other educational research initiatives too. But you know, some of that stuff got stalled by COVID, understandably.
What do you think? What do you see with your patients as being like the number one stumbling block, or is it very like person to person?
It definitely varies, but you've hit on the key thing: behavior change. Like we all kind of know that eating more kale is good for us, but getting ourselves to do it is often a problem. And I think the biggest thing is it's just not baked into society. Like we're not geared to be healthy. You know, there's most the food bill, you know, supports to the tune of billions and billions of dollars, not necessarily healthy items. And agribusiness. You know, there's tons of fast food restaurants all over the place. There are bodegas that don't necessarily have the healthiest foods. You know, the people around us, because of this system we live in, are not eating healthfully. And so, you know, we may talk about it with patients, and then they go home and, you know, it's just harder. The activation energy is hard because society is not geared like that. It's harder to find all the fresh vegetables and then maybe the Maybe you live in a food desert. You know, maybe you don't feel safe walking to the supermarket that's an extra 5 blocks away. Just all kinds of hurdles are in the way of that happening. And you know, that's why we really push that we don't want to have perfection be the enemy of good. And even if patients are able to make some changes, we're super excited about that. But I think the biggest hurdle is that society needs change.
Yeah. So, and that really, to me, resonates with Dan Buettner's work with the Blue Zones. And as you said earlier in the podcast, you know, we gotta figure out a way, really, as a society, to make the healthy choice the easy choice, right? So it's not a huge lift.
Yeah. I totally agree. I mean, that's the key.
Yeah.
I mean, and you can, you know, not that this, I don't necessarily get into this with in the medical world, but you know, clearly animal agribusiness creates more greenhouse gases than all transportation combined, which of course includes cars. And you know, who cares how healthy you are if there's no planet? You know, no planet, no health. So it all aligns.
It's so true. You know, there's a study that came out. I just got it like 2 weeks ago. I don't know if you know who Silesh Rao is, but he started a nonprofit called Climate Healers. And this study, it's in part Stanford and another organization, shows that, you know, the global greenhouse gas emissions emitted by animal agriculture aren't 15%, which is basically what all forms of transportation are, aren't 51% as the World Health Organization or the World Bank commissioned a report in 2009 called Livestock's Long Shadow. And that showed it was 51%. This latest report shows it's 87%.
Oh,
it's like mind blowing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So again, it's like, you know, as you just said, I mean, we got to collectively get behind this and get behind this in a hurry. Otherwise, you know, we're kind of doomed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, New York City will be underwater pretty soon.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Not pretty. Not pretty. Yep. But in the meantime, the miracle at Montefiore, you got to do a book.
Yeah. Well, maybe after the erectile function study, like, I don't know. Every now and again, I think about it, but like, I don't have, like, my heart isn't there. My passion isn't there for that. You know, it's fun. I like, you know, giving the talks and writing articles and, you know, teaching the residents and fellows and my, right now my passion's there. Maybe after the erectile function study is done, I'll revisit the idea of a book.
Yeah.
And we actually even just launched a podcast called Cardio Nutrition through the American College of Cardiology geared toward cardiologists, you know, about diet.
Fantastic.
So we're hoping to move the needle there.
Is that something that you're hosting?
Yeah.
Wow. When did you start it?
Like, honestly, it launched yesterday.
Great. Good. Well, is that open to everybody to listen to?
It is open to everybody. They are bite-sized. They're like 10 to 20 minute interviews. So they're real quick. And it's like about whole grains and about fats and about protein and about dietary patterns and the guidelines. So it's really meant to be, you know, a bite-sized, friendly approach to diet.
That's smart.
That will hopefully be helpful for patients and cardiologists.
That's smart. I'd love to have you back on and we can talk about TMAO and heme iron and, you know, all those things that basically contribute to heart disease. But I want you to get it back to Montefiore and all the wonderful things you're doing there. But I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to join us on the Plant Strong podcast. You know, I wish you all the best, my Plant Strong brother.
Oh, well, thank you. The work you guys are doing is total inspiration. Your father's work is the inspiration for our program and all the, you know, ripple effects thereof. So thank you. Thank your family. Thank you for this opportunity. And it's great to connect.
Thank you. Hey, sign off with me. Ready? Peace.
Peace.
Engine 2.
Engine 2.
Keep it plant strong.
Plant strong. All right.
Yeah. I find doctors like Dr. Robert Osfeld to be absolutely so refreshing. And With doctors like him on the front lines, I am optimistic that real change can and will happen in our healthcare system. But the key is we're going to have to pivot from the current focus, which is on sickness, back to health where it all belongs. It's about prevention, prevention, prevention. For more information on today's show, simply visit the episode page at PlanStrongPodcast.com. And next week, get ready because I speak to the most authentic and compassionate guest that I've ever had the privilege of speaking to. I'm sure that it will leave a huge imprint on you, just like it did me, and you do not want to miss it. I'll see you then. Thanks. Thank you for listening to the Plan Strong podcast. You can support the show by taking a quick minute to follow us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Leaving us a positive review and sharing the show with your network is another great way to help us reach as many people as possible with the exciting news about plants. Thank you in advance for your support. It means everything. Have you had your own Galileo moment that you'd like to share? What happened when you stepped into the arena and shed the beliefs that you thought to be true? I'd love to hear about it. Visit PlantStrongPodcast.com to submit your story and to learn more about today's guests and sponsors. The Plant Strong Podcast team includes Carrie Barrett, Lori Kordowich, Amy Mackey, Patrick Gavin, and Wade Clark. This season is dedicated to all of those courageous truth seekers who weren't afraid to look through the lens with clear vision and hold firm to a higher truth. Most notably, my parents, Dr. Caldwell B. Esselstyn Jr. and Anne Cryle Esselstyn. Thanks for listening. This is a man who is the real deal through and through. He has... I want to personally invite you to join me and all the other Brock stars for this year's 13th live and in-person Plant Stock event outside of Asheville, North Carolina in the little town of Black Mountain. It's 1,500 acres, is loaded with wildlife, trees, trails, streams. It is a nature wonderland. And what's also a wonderland are all the incredible speakers that you get to hang with all weekend long, like Jane and Ann Esselstyn, Dr. Will Bolshewitz of Fiberfueled, Carly Bodrug, Miss Plant U, Dr. Gemma Newman is over from the UK. We have Dr. Dawn Musalem from the Mayo Clinic, John Mackey, the ex-CEO of Whole Food Market Stores, myself, Brian Hart, and a special appearance by the Plant Bros. Here's the kicker. All these Brock stars are there from Friday till Sunday, and they want to rub elbows with all of you, whether it's over buffets of Plant Strong fare for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, whether it's going on an afternoon hike, a swim, pickleball, frisbee golf, kickball, cornhole, dancing. We're having live music. It's all there in this fun weekend extravaganza that we affectionately call Plant Stock. Simply go to liveplantstrong.com and then click on Plant Stock 2024 and grab yourself a ticket before they sell out. See you there.